evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, December 10, 2018. South Sudanese say good governance can save their country from conflict. And a former South Sudanese refugee wins a prestigious award. We'll bring details on these stories right here on South Sudan in Focus. The Juba-based SAD Institute organized a public lecture over the weekend to discuss governance and stability in South Sudan. Abraham Awolish, acting executive director for the SAD Institute, says South Sudanese leaders must adopt strategies to improve governance during the implementation phase of the revitalized agreement on the resolution of conflict in South Sudan. Winnie Chirino reports for VOA from Juba.
Awolish says poor infrastructure and a lack of manpower are some of the most serious problems that South Sudan has faced for the past 7 years.
We are facing some challenges in the area of governance, and that include limitation in the capacity of state, especially in five broad areas, bureaucracy and administration, which is civil service in general, is not strong, is not performing to the best of its ability. Second, the legal capacity of the state to enforce law and to carry out judicial decisions is also weak. We also look at the capacity of the state to generate resources and manage them effectively, and that is also not as strong as it needs to be.
Peter Duoknyaba, former Minister for Higher Education, Science and Technology, says leaders in South Sudan should put national interest above politics, saying South Sudanese need what he calls a paradigm shift.
Governance, in my opinion, is important in a state's stability. But in the present context of South Sudan, it would be unrealistic to demand governance as practiced in Western world or in African countries which have become independent 50 years ago. This is because, as South Sudanese, we are still living in and organized as communities, even at the political level. So that's why you have now the Council of Elders. The Jing started it, and the Nuefs also, and others have adopted it. No nation can be built on the basis of dividing ourselves as ethnicity.
Awolish blames a lack of accountability for the country's problems. He says South Sudan will remain an authoritarian nation if it continues to rely heavily on oil revenues.
Oil rents to be used for development and services to citizens only. But the day-to-day function of the government should be financed through taxation. That way, citizens will have a voice in demanding government to do things that they demand.
The former governor of Northern Borgazal says many activities in the implementation matrix of the peace deal have yet to be accomplished. Agra says the three-year period stipulated in the agreement may not be enough for conducting elections on time. He claims South Sudanese leaders are not interested in the next election because they don't believe they can win.
The effectiveness of the so-called pre-interim period implementation committee. Now the chair is in honeymoon. Nobody knows when he's going to reconstitute the committee. And many timelines are already elapsed, particularly the formation of the National Army, which is key to the formation of the government or the revitalized transitional government of national unity.
Ajonye Papecha, acting chairperson for South Sudan Law Society, says equal treatment of all South Sudanese communities can end violence in the country.
We are 64 tribes in the republic. I differ with people who say some of the tribes are ahead. There's no tribe which is ahead in the Republic of South Sudan or older in age. The 64 tribes' agenda should be looked in every program of ours in diversity, not necessarily physical representation, but in heart and spirit as a country, as one people.
The SUD Institute says until governance is fixed, South Sudan's vicious cycle of violence will continue unabated. For VOA News, I am Wayne Sereno in Juba.
A self-taught game programmer and a former South Sudanese refugee, Luol Mayen, has been recognized as Global Gaming Citizens at this year's Game Awards in Los Angeles, which is sponsored in part by Facebook Gaming. It is the first year the gaming ceremony has presented the award. Mayen, founder of Junoob Games, taught himself how to program after his mother, who was also a refugee in Uganda, saved money for 3 years to buy Mayen a computer. Upon receiving the gaming industry biggest award ceremony late last week, he tells Ayen Bior he is still in disbelief that the industry recognized his contributions.
It's never something I've ever dreamt of, to be one of the global gaming citizen, because you know, the game industry is it's a very big industry, it's huge, and for someone to penetrate into it and be recognized at the Game Award, it's a lifetime honor for me. And you know, like the game, you know, the independent games and all the game designers, you know, come together every year to celebrate games, and you know, in Los Angeles, and this is like the biggest gaming, you know, award in the world. And for me, as someone who just, you know, I trained myself on how to make games, I never dreamed of making games one day. And for me, it's like to be recognized by the game industry. It's something that means so much to me a lot. When I started making games for peace building and conflict resolution, I thought it was something that is so different from other game. But being able to see that the industries are able to recognize game for such a good, it really, you know, made me so happy.
Luol, credit also goes to your mother. During the Game Awards, they showed a video of you, and in the video, it mentioned that your mom was the one who actually bought you your first computer, and she had saved for years to buy you that computer, which then enabled you to learn how to program.
Exactly. And I mean, like, you know, and that's why, like, I'm really so proud of my mother, because actually, first thing, even right now, when I tell her like I'm a game designer, she doesn't understand what I do. But because she's a mom, she wanted the best for me. You know, she had to sacrifice all, like, you know, all she had to do to get me the computer, and she's really amazing. And that's why they managed to, without our contribution, actually my story wouldn't actually be where I am today. But because she spent most of the time, you know, tailoring and getting some money to buy for me a laptop. It really, like, I was so happy when I was talking to her yesterday, and I told her, like, you know, I've been recognized because of the work that you've been doing. And, you know, some of your work have been shown to the world. And, like, she's really so happy, and, you know, she deserves everything, you know.
How did you come up with the idea to use games for peace?
You know, one day I start playing a game called GTA Vice City. It's one of the most violent games. Like, it's really so violent, but a lot of people love it. But when I was playing that game, I was like, I was so addicted. I was like, I love the game. I like the gameplay. I love everything. But when I thought to myself, I was like, okay, how about using the same type of game for social impact, to help people, like, instead of killing people, why don't you, like, save people's life? Why don't you, like, build a community? So in the game, you know, in the game, because games are really very, very important, and people love them. And, for example, I can say, like, a lot of people, especially the young people, love playing games. And if we want to, like, make a better world, then we have to target the young people by using game for, you know, for peace, for social innovation, for social good. So we can impact people's life other than, like, you know, playing war every day. It become like what we think. It become what we do every time. So, like, I felt like, you know, playing that game really inspired me a lot to start the same version of peace building.
So, Luol, tell me, what is the future of gaming?
The future of gaming is really good, because when I was at the Microsoft Theater, and, like, there was, like, thousands of people, and seeing, like, games being played and seeing, like, and actually having interaction with different game designers. I actually met with the president of Nintendo. So, like, and I had a conversation with him, and he was telling me a story that, you know, games right now, like, are really advancing, and they're looking into, like, the stories and how they can be able to change. Because each game has a story. And that means, like, you know, the game industry is actually going to be bigger than and more impactful than the film industry.
That was Lual Mayen, creator of Junoob Games and recipient of this year's Global Gaming Citizen Award. He was speaking to Ayen Dengbior from Washington. Still on technology, startup Karno is a techno hub that allows young entrepreneurs to connect, grow, and expand their businesses. It is also one of the digital platforms in Karno, Nigeria, that provides support for other startups. It provides an enabling environment that enhances connectivity and provides a meeting place for other like-minded entrepreneurs. Aisha Tofa is one of the co-founders, named among the 2017 100 Most Inspiring Women in Nigeria by the Guardian newspaper. She talks to Karno-based reporter Nasiba Ibrahim about some of the achievements of the organization.
What makes us different from other hubs in Karno is, first, we offer co-working spaces, and with these co-working spaces, we have subscriptions for three categories of people. We have for students, for startups, and for freelancers. So when you come in with your business, we offer you a space, internet, and of course, tea. So you can meet a lot of people with different startups, and from there you get to collaborate and work together. Also, we organize demo days where startups will come and pitch their businesses to investors, and from there they can get investments. Also, we have a women community, like the WinTech community. It's the first of its kind in Kano. We also have the Facebook developer cycle for women and other communities like that. So with that, I think we are very different from other hubs in Kano.
Okay, what sort of achievements have you recorded since the inception of your company?
Okay, we have a reach of over 1,000 women that are in business. We have incubated more than 10 startups and they are fully running. We have been recognized by both international and local organizations, and we have worked with them, and we are also creating more partnerships with these organizations.
Yeah, can you explain at least succinctly one or two success stories that you've recorded?
Yeah, of course. We have Samaha's Collection. She's just 16 years old and she's a fashion designer. She's already up and running. We also have Afmam. Afmam are into shoes and bags making, and they're doing very excellent.
How many startups and other businesses has this platform been able to help?
Okay, we are currently working with over 50 startups in Kano and outside Kano. Some we collaborate, some we accelerate them. We do events with them. So far we are working with over 50.
Has the help provided to any of these businesses created jobs for youths and reduced the number of unemployed youths here in Kano, or unemployment generally?
Yeah, of course. Like the Samaha's Collection and Afmam I have mentioned, they all have staff and other startups too that are working with us in the hub.
What kind of challenges have you experienced in the course of carrying your work since you started?
Actually, the major challenge has been awareness. You know, the North is not really keen with technology stuff, so we have to work. We've been working very hard, you know, to introduce a lot of things that, you know, that is linked with technology.
What kind of solutions do you think, if available, will solve these challenges that you face?
I think mainly is the resources. If we can have enough resources, we'll make more awareness, we'll do more classes, more, you know, events, seminars and stuff like that to make everything go okay.
That was Aisha Tofa. She was speaking from Kano with reporter Nasiba Ibrahim. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at a deadly plane crash in Sudan. We'll bring details after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
where do you get your health advice from?
Sometimes I get my health advice from my grandmother, who is at home. When I'm sick that I can't control myself, she'll help.
I get my health advice from my friend, colleague, who live together. Well, those who know about, those who have been experiencing more problems about health, they don't advise me through phone. We talk, we chat, discuss everything.
My dad, because my dad is a doctor.
I'd say I get my health advice from various places, the internet, my parents, because I have, my mother is a nurse.
My health advice, I get it on the internet. If I need something on how to deal with obesity, I get it on the internet. Anything I need pertaining to health advice is on the internet.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. At least 7 people were killed on Sunday in a plane crash in Gadarif State in eastern Sudan. Sudan State News Agency reported that among the victims of the plane crash was the governor of Gadarif State. Gadarif State's agriculture minister and senior security officials were among those on board the ill-fated aircraft. The report did not mention the cause of the accident. Besides Ethiopia, Gadarif shares borders with Khartoum and Kassala states. Sudan's military and civilian fleet consists largely of old Soviet-made aircraft. Sunday was International Anti-Corruption Day. The UN says $1 trillion is paid every year in bribes, while an estimated $2.6 trillion are stolen annually through corruption. The UN Development Programme says funds lost to corruption in developing countries is 10 times the amount of official development assistance. In Zambia, President Edgar Lungu said yesterday his government is committed in making Zambia a corruption-free zone in Africa. But a Sunday report said the German government revealed that Zambian officials forged signatures in an attempt to embezzle €3 million in development funds. Spokesman Amos Chanda tells VOA's James Batty that President Lungu promised Zambia's cooperation with the international community in the fight against corruption.
The president pressed the occasion, which is essentially sanctioned by Transparency International Zambia, the local chapter of Transparency International. They invited him for the event and used the occasion to outline the institutional reforms that he has instituted since he took office in 2015, and called upon all stakeholders, government officials, the opposition, the civil society, the donor community, to fight corruption without politicizing it, because the scourge of corruption has a negative impact on all facets of life. So he wanted all stakeholders to pull in one direction and not try and score political points in the fight against corruption, because it was too important a matter to narrow down to political scheming.
So along those lines, what do you make of this article that's published on Sunday, saying that the Zambian government forged signatures to $3 million euros from Germany?
The internal audit system of the Zambian government detected attempted fraud in that regard, and therefore appropriate action was taken, which is why the internal audit system in the government exists, is to detect possible fraud. An individual attempted to do that. He was handed over to the Minister of Finance. Disciplinary action was taken, and all the money involved was reinvested. That is how the system works. The government cannot steal money. Individuals within government can attempt to do that, which is why the anti-corruption watchdog exists here in the UK, in Norway, in the United States, and elsewhere. Which is why the police exists, is to take care of anomalies such as that one.
That's Zambia's presidential spokesman, Amos Chanda, speaking with my colleague, James Batty. Efforts to boost global action against climate change are stuttering, as several key nations have objected to key United Nations-backed report on the impact of rising temperatures at the COP24 talks in Poland. Many developing nations say they are already suffering from the effects of climate change, especially in South Asia and Africa, where water shortages and intense storm are putting lives and livelihoods in danger. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Five months ago, a bustling fish market stood at Kachulu on the shores of Malawi's Lake Chilwa. Now hundreds of fishing boats lie marooned across the vast bay as vultures circle over the cracked, sun-baked mud. Water levels here fluctuate annually, but scientists say climate change is making the seasonal dry out of the lake far more dramatic. Fishermen are being forced to leave and look for work elsewhere, says Sosten Chiota of the non-governmental organisation LEED, Leadership for Environment and Development.
Climate change contributes to the current recessions that we are experiencing. Because you can see that in 2012, there was a recession where the lake lost about 80% of its water. Then it recovered in 2013, but not fully. So since then, every year, we've been experiencing these recessions.
Policymakers gathering at the COP24 climate talks say it is developing countries like Malawi that are being hit hardest by the impacts of climate change. The charity WaterAid has released a report ranking the countries worst hit by water shortages, with Sudan, Niger and Pakistan making up the top three. WaterAid's Jonathan Farr spoke to VOA via Skype from the COP24 conference.
There's people who are living with the impacts of climate change right now, and they're feeling those impacts not through carbon but through water. And as we've seen over the past few years, and will continue to see for many years to come, unfortunately, is a huge increase in water stress and absolute water scarcity.
Richer nations have pledged $100 billion a year for poorer nations to deal with the consequences of climate change, but WaterAid says they are failing to deliver. Scientists say emissions of carbon dioxide would have to be reduced by 45% to have any hope of keeping global warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius, the target agreed in the Paris climate deal. But the number of coal-fired power stations, the most polluting form of energy generation, is growing. The German organisation Urgewald calculates that $478 billion had been invested into expansion of the coal industry between January 2016 and September 2018, including in Africa. Urgewald's director, Heffer Schuking.
14 African countries now, the first coal plants are being developed. It's completely crazy. Economies that could just be leapfrogging to a renewable energy economy that instead are having, largely by foreign companies, having coal plants being pushed on them as a solution to energy problems.
Meanwhile, the World Health Organization warns that climate change will exacerbate the impact of some diseases and health problems, including malaria, malnutrition, and heat exposure. There is little optimism at the talks that much concrete progress will be made, as several countries, including the United States, Russia, and Saudi Arabia, have already voiced objections to a key scientific report from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
On December 23rd, voters in the Democratic Republic of Congo elect a new president and parliament in elections delayed for 2 years. Incumbent President Joseph Kabila, who has governed since 2001, is barred by the constitution from running. His hand-picked candidate, Emmanuel Ramadhani Shadari, is considered favoured in the campaign, despite being under sanctions from the European Union for his past role in surpassing the opposition. VOA French to Africa reporter Anastasie Tudesi is in Kinshasa covering the campaign. She spoke with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson about how it's progressing.
Well, the campaign has been going very diversely, depending on if you are in Kinshasa or in the cities inside the country. In Kinshasa, you will see more of presidential candidates banners, and also more and more of parliament chair seekers. Whereas inside the country, it's more of the local deputies that people see more, but it started very slowly because the deputies were waiting for money. that didn't come, that was not coming, that was very slow to come. So it's a difficult campaign for the local deputies because they are lacking money, they are lacking means, and it's not very easy, as you can imagine, to visit the whole country. Let's just remind our listeners that DRC is the biggest country, sub-Saharan African country.
Now, yesterday, President Joseph Kabila, who is constitutionally barred from running this time, gave two interviews in which he said, at least two interviews, in which he said that he would not rule out running for office again in the future. How has that been received there in the DRC?
So far, I haven't noticed any move of rebellion or anger or even the lack thereof. Congolese people are really a, you know, right now they live their lives day after one day after another. They take life one day after another. One thing I can tell you is that they will not let these elections be stolen from them. They have reached a point where really these elections better happen. And they better be sure that the elections are transparent, and they really want to make sure that they won't be stolen from what they want to see as the head of this country.
Now, there's one woman running for president, and there are several women running for deputies. How are they being received in the campaign? Is there support for the female candidates?
Well, 52% of Congolese are female, so they are well received. Marie-Josée Ifoku is the woman running for president here, and she has been. I would say that she really doesn't care. She's not asking herself if men are not too, are not too angry or are okay with. Her running for president. She really is a very strong woman, and she's opinionated, and she even offered her profile, her name, to gather all of these opponents who couldn't find just one man. And she said, since you failed, let me be your guy. So this is for the woman running for president. As for deputies, there are many. You can see them all over the city of Kinshasa. And they are pretty well received. You know, women are very strong here. Congolese women are very strong. They are the pillar of the society and of family. And it's only natural, even if I've done some vox pops and asked men, and they kept telling me that that's not where a woman should be. And that's very interesting to hear people in the street saying that and see these women running for deputy chair and, you know, having some support.
That was VOA reporter Anastasia Tudeshi in Kinshasa, speaking with VOA's Kate Dawson. That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with Rebecca singing a gospel song. That was a test of a gospel melody from South Africa by Rebecca. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We appreciate you making us part of your evening. Would like to know what you think about this show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. If you're planning to be out of Juba where there are no VOA FM stations, you can still listen to us. Our frequencies are 11850 kHz, 13865 kHz, and 15180 kHz. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.